let's talk and let's laugh, cause I got so much to tell you, so let's go kick some art.
Kia ora, and welcome to Kick Arts, proudly brought to you this August by the Dolphin Theatre. Kick Arts is Aotearoa's comprehensive art show, brought to you on Planet FM 104.6 and streaming live around the globe thanks to our podcasts, which you can download from planetaudio.org.nz or find us on Spotify. On the show tonight, we are talking cabaret, theatre, musicals and puppets. But to kick things off, on the same day as his record launch, here is veteran activist Roger Fowler with his new voice, which is ringing loud for the people of Gaza, with Your Welcome Here from his album, as I said, launching tonight, Songs of Struggle and Solidarity.
Well, you say that you've been searching for a place you've never been. Well, here it is. Here it is. When you're down there at the bottom and you're looking for a friend, well, here I am. Here I am. When you're growing tired of running after rainbows, well, have no fear, you're welcome here. When it feels like you've been drifting and you don't know where you've been, well, come on in, you can come on in. When you've gone tired of running after rainbows, well, have no fear, you're welcome here. And if all you've seen is back roads that lead you out of town, well, turn around, turn around. When you're growing tired of running after rainbows, we'll have no fear, you're welcome here. So hide am I, hide am I, you're welcome here, you're welcome here.
Well, thank you for that, Roger, and thank you for making us feel welcome here. Roger's a friend from way back. I was on stage with him many years ago in the Buddy Holly story, and in the background of that, the backing singer there was Tia Ormsby, who we've heard of a few times in the past on the radio, who is currently studying down at Toi Whakaari. So thank you for that, Roger. Now, we've got a really busy show, but to kick things off, I'm actually calling down to Sonia Ifai down in the Hawke's Bay, Napier. Kia ora, Sonia.
Kia ora, Emma. How are you?
Very good, thank you. I'm glad to be inside in what is a storm up here. It's not very nice weather.
Not that great here either.
Now, I'm ringing to talk to you about the National Big Theatre Open Weekend run by Musical Theatre New Zealand. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, so the Big Theatre Open Weekend is an opportunity for the musical theatre societies in New Zealand to open their doors to the public and get together any like-minded people, schools, communities that might want to come and find out more about the theatre. It's a nationwide event.
Fantastic. So for people that don't know, what is Musical Theatre New Zealand?
Musical Theatre New Zealand is the national association that works for and represents all the musical societies in New Zealand, and they affiliate to us and we are their governing body and their support.
Now, it's quite funny that I'm interviewing you because, of course, your position with MTNZ is you are the Zone 3 rep. So what is Zone 3 for people that don't know?
Well, Zone 3 stretches from New Plymouth down to Wellington, up to Napier and everything in between. And I work for those societies, supporting them, visiting their shows, advising them, whatever help they need. And so I'm their representative on the National Executive.
Which, of course, for our listeners that don't know, I sit as the president on that association. Hence why I said it was a bit funny interviewing you, acting like I don't know what we're talking about when I do. So tell us, this initiative has been going since 2019, which was just a little bit before COVID, but it really kicked off quite strong after COVID, didn't it?
It did. A lot of the theatres were feeling quite isolated. They hadn't been able to do shows. They hadn't been able to get the community into their doors. And so it was a good way to open it up and just say, you know, theatre is alive and kicking. Make sure you come back and see us. And that's where it's carried on from there.
So what are some things maybe that have been done in the last 4 or 5 years?
Okay, so most of the societies will open their doors and have an open day. There's open rehearsals where you can go and watch a bit of rehearsal. And it might be choreography, it might be some directing, it might be a snippet of the show. I know at Napier Operatic we did a cavalcade of costumes, which was a fashion parade of all the costumes used in shows over the last so many years. That was very, very popular.
And that was actually, that doubled as a fundraiser, didn't it? For because you had, was it 5 kids that were going across to America with Kiwi All-Stars?
That's right, and it fundraised for them. It was a great fundraiser and a great way to showcase the theatre. And the kids did all the design and they did all the modelling and everything, yeah.
And the thing is too, like, I bet a lot of people in local community don't actually realise the amazing resource that theatres have in the way of a costume room.
No, they don't. They don't realise that we've got sewing rooms, we've got costumes for hire, we've got costumes out the back that extra from the hire wardrobe, and yeah, they just don't know.
Yeah, so throwing the doors open, I know too that some studios, for example, performing arts studios, offer maybe workshops over that weekend.
Yes, we've done things like lighting workshops or sound workshops or even prop making workshops. We've done makeup workshops. We've also done things like when you're having a show on, we might do an Q&A for the audience after the show with the cast, or a backstage tour is another thing, because people don't realise for one person on stage, there's probably another 10 backstage.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a really good way because, you know, people do, as we all know, for theatre, like especially people moving to a new town. We were actually talking about it with a guest a couple of weeks ago about the fact that it was joining the local theatre group when they moved to a town was the way that they found friends.
Absolutely. And you don't have to be a performer. You can be a builder that likes to build sets, or a painter, or someone just likes to help in the restaurant part, or you don't have to actually be a performer to be a part of it.
Yeah, no, definitely. So when is National Big Theatre Open Weekend happening this year?
This year it's happening on the 26th to the 28th of September.
So we really encourage anyone listening that's part of a dance studio or a school theatre program or a local community group or maybe a venue, throw your doors open for Big Theatre Open Weekend. Make sure you tell MTNZ what's happening. So on our social media, we've got a Google form at the moment that you can fill in, and we've got a page on our website, which is mtnz.org.nz, that you can fill in. And then we've got a calendar there, so we'll be marketing what's happening over the weekend on your behalf as well to help make you visible.
Absolutely. We want to make it as visible as possible to all sorts of people.
So come and join us somewhere through the country, or let us know what you are doing so we can market you. And hey, if you've got something going on, let Kick Arts know as well, because we are definitely all about making people visible in any kind of arts arena. Hey, thanks for jumping on the phone tonight, Sonny. I know it was short, but the main thing is that people know that MTNZ are there, we're loud and proud, and we're throwing our doors open for Big Theatre Open Weekend. Go and enjoy the rest of your Sunday. Stay warm.
You too. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Right. Well, now I'm jumping with our and straight back into our studio with our first guest who's patiently been sitting here waiting. So welcome back to the show, not a first-time guest, a second-time guest, from Cabaret Coven, it's Fanny McBangers.
Hi, how are you?
Good, I should probably turn your microphone on, shouldn't I? There we go.
Yes, I was Yes, I was wondering maybe I couldn't hear it, but you could, but yes.
No, it was just me going, oh my goodness, I've got to turn around and press that on button. So first of all, it's been a while since you've been here, so tell us, who and what is Cabaret Coven? Is it Coven or Coven?
Coven.
Coven.
Yes.
Like a coven of witches.
Exactly. Yes.
And is that where the name came from? Is it that idea of it being a group of...
Yeah,
of
very much so. It's sort of, yeah, very equal kind of group of performers who, I mean, it started from conversations backstage at a burlesque show between myself and a couple of other Auckland performers, basically bemoaning the fact that there weren't that many shows for performers in Auckland, at least not if you didn't do classical burlesque, which, no shade to classical burlesque, it's amazing, it's polished, it's beautiful, but there's this whole other world beyond the sort of Dita Von Teese style of burlesque that's weird and wonderful, and it can be stupid or gory or, you know, just very, very, I mean, often very, very moving in all sorts of different ways, but there just weren't that many opportunities, that many shows that had space for that kind of performance, and so we decided to make one.
I suppose that's the way a lot of things do eventuate, yeah, though, isn't it? People kind of
acknowledge...
You make
the thing that you want to see.
Yeah, you acknowledge a gap, and you kind of go, well, I want to do that, and if I want to do it, I need to do it myself. So where does someone learn how to do something like burlesque? Like, are there classes? And, like, I know you can go to burlesque classes, like heels classes and things like that, probably more in that traditional style.
Yeah, but and those classes are a fantastic grounding. Like, there's important stuff in there to learn, and it is really, I think, great to know the history of the art form and know all those, you know, the things that are the staples of burlesque that an audience will always recognize as, yes, that's definitely burlesque, like the boa or the gloves coming off in particular ways. But then once you've done the classes, the best way to build on that is to be just getting stage time and trying things out, you know, having an idea and running with it. And that can be really hard to do if you don't have the stage time. But yeah, I would definitely recommend starting with some classes just to sort of get into even just getting used to the idea of being in your underwear in front of other people, because that can be quite confronting. But then again, when you've done it, suddenly it's less scary to do again, and you start to get a little bit braver.
So what got you into burlesque?
Originally, sorry, I hate that but so originally I'd gotten out of a really bad relationship, and I wanted to do something to reclaim my body for myself. And the thing that I love about burlesque is that it is very empowering in terms of the person on stage is deciding how much you see and what you see and when you see it and how things come off. Like, that, all that power is with the performer. And so for me, it was part of a healing journey. And did it for a while, wasn't really getting anywhere, so I sort of retired for a chunk of time. And then my now husband sort of said, oh, you know, I wish I could have seen you perform, because that would have been really fun. And I decided, oh, you know, I'll do some classes again, you know, get back into it with going back to just learning and growing that way. And then the culmination of the classes was a graduate showcase, and once I got on stage, I thought, no, I've really missed this.
Well, there's a real bug about performing, isn't there? There's that, I mean, no matter what kind of performance you're doing, we all do it for that kind of buzz. that adrenaline rush, whether that, and for, like, I know for me now performing, man, that buzz often is huge anxiety. But once you've done it, that feeling of I did it is just so, like, wow.
Yeah.
So tell us, because normally with the cabaret coven shows, there is kind of a theme. Where does this one come from? So it's called Ouch, Right in the Childhood, which kind of makes me think, is that someone being, you know, kicked in that area or what? What is this?
It's, so it comes from that I'd seen so many great acts that audiences really connect with that are based on childhood characters or children's media. So, for example, acts that we've got coming up on Saturday night are things like The Muppets or Burlesque Winnie the Pooh. We've even got we've got Drag Rainbow Fish, and it's taking those things that are instantly recognisable that you remember from your childhood that you can often have some real big feelings about still, and giving them a twist, taking that artistic interpretation and using them to say something. Because for me, the best burlesque performers, the best drag performers will take you on a journey and they'll have a message that you'll sort of get to feel. And again, it's right in the childhood.
Nice.
And as I say, it's also kind of poking fun at the fact that we do still get upset about things that upset us as kids in terms of media, like anybody who's seen Neverending Story, Artax the Horse in the Swamp. I have a friend who started quoting that movie at a mate of mine and I, and we were both like, no, too soon. You know, I see it for the first time when I'm 7 years old. It's still too soon.
I think Watership Downs used to be that kind of thing as well, didn't it? I remember thinking about it now, how on earth was that something for children?
So it's taking something that will instantly connect, but it's also just having fun with it, because it can be fun to sort of put that different spin on things and make you think in that way or make you laugh.
So how many people are in this particular night?
A few. So we've got, I think it's eight or nine solo acts, and then we've got one army of drag kings. So it's quite a few performers we'll be getting up on stage, but we've got, our drag king troupe that usually does an act at any of our shows is Chaotic by Energy. And so they've been working very, very hard choreographing their socks off for a very large act, which I don't want to spoil too much about, but if you've ever wanted to see an army of Ken dolls dancing around on stage, this is the show to come to.
So do your shows have like an overall artistic director or a director? Because I'm assuming that these people that come in are kind of individual burlesque people in their own right.
Yes.
So do you have someone that pulls that together for the coven?
So we have a central committee who take turns being lead producer on the different shows, and part of, you know, yes, there's work involved in that, but the payoff for it is that you get a say in putting your hand up and saying, I've got an idea for a theme, because each show has a very distinct theme, and we try and make it something that audiences will want to see, but also something that performers can connect with, because some of the acts that we've got, for example, for Saturday night, some of them are ones that performers have been doing for years. They're most requested acts, they're really popular, but we've also got brand new ones that people have come up with just for this show, because having a theme, having that kind of structure to it or something to spur the ideas is really great for the creative process. And for newer performers, it's great to sort of see further down the line, okay, that theme's coming up and I think that I could do this.
Yeah. So we were talking before we came on here actually about where you're performing and where you rehearse. So tell us a little bit about the Factory Theatre and Ke Te Aranui.
And how wonderful they are. Mm. So we would not be doing what we're doing now without Factory. They've been incredibly supportive, and it's just a fantastic venue. I mean, it's, I remember my co-producer Hot Dish coming sort of early in the planning phases of our very first show, saying, I've just been to a show at this place called The Factory, and this, you know, this is the venue, this is the venue we've been looking for. It's, you know, it's got free parking, it's right close to public transport, which is always really helpful when it's not in the middle of Auckland, because people can be a bit funny about, oh, it's not in central Auckland. Actually, no, this is a fantastic place to come, and it's an easy place to get to. It's got, the stage is such that wherever you're sitting, you've got a good view, because I've performed in quite a few venues around the country where it's more kind of, if you're not in the VIP seats, you're probably not going to be able to see that much.
Mm.
Which, if that's what you can get, that's what you can get. But for this one, everybody can see what's going on. Everybody gets a, you know, good dose of the show. And so for our VIP is the first two rows. So that just means that you're more likely to get hassled by one of the performers. They've got an aerial rig, which is amazing. So we're the first group to come in that actually used it. And I remember Connie from Factory being extremely excited that somebody was finally using this beautiful aerial rig. Drinks and food and all the things you need for a great night out is right there. And then the rehearsal space, Ke Te Aranui, it's low cost, but it's really high quality. You know, you've got the different sizes of rooms for whatever size of group you need. They've got the mirrors and stuff. It's the perfect
place
to be doing things. So, you know, the Ken rehearsals would be a lot more difficult without being able to book Kitty, and considerably more expensive.
Definitely. So, you know, if you want to check that out, listeners, it's Ke Te Aranui or The Factory, and they've got a website and really easy to book in at Ke Te, and their rooms range from $8 an hour for a smaller room up to the large room, which I've actually had 30 kids in there before in those big rooms.
I can believe it.
You know, and that's kind of like, I think the largest one's $18 an hour or $12 an hour for the middle size one, which again is really decent size.
Yeah.
Mirrors, dance floors, yes.
Everything you could need.
So check it out, people. Let's have a quick music break. Yep. Coming up, so this is Emma Rutherford's latest track, which has only just come out a couple of days ago, and this is called Midnight.
Standing when you feel it in the distance. a difference. That's when you know it's new in the coffin. Going the distance, thought it'd be different. Nobody's listening when you're forgotten. Going the distance, don't make a difference. That's when you know it's new in the coffin. Going the distance, thought it'd be different. Nobody's listening when you're forgotten. Going the distance, don't make a difference. That's when you know it's new in the coffin. Going the distance, thought it'd be different. Nobody's listening when you're forgotten. Going the distance, don't make a difference. That's when you know it's new.
And that was Emma Rutherford's Midnight. Again, thank you to our friends New Hatchlings for keeping us up to date with what new Kiwi music is coming out. So we're back with Fanny McBangers. Tell me, how do burlesque people get their names?
So it depends. I can tell you how I got mine. So my one came from my brother, who was staying in a hotel in Hong Kong, and the TV was on the blink, and it was telling him at the bottom of the screen that what was on the screen was a movie called Carry On, Carry On. And he took a photo of that and posted it online with the caption starring Barbara Windsor as Nurse Fanny McBangers. And I looked at that and I thought, that is the best burlesque name that I've ever heard. So then with his blessing, I stole with pride. For other people, it can be making a pun or just researching different, you know, you get to sort of know the style of a lot of the names, and so it'll come from thinking about the kind of burlesque that you want to do. Just like I think with drag as well, it comes from what kind of thing do you want to put on stage, and can you come up with a name that can kind of hint at that. So with a name like Fanny McBangers, you can probably guess that a lot of what I do is very silly. But there are lots of sort of very sort of luxurious, beautiful or elegant or dark gothic names. So for example, you've got Nocturnus, who's very much the horror, gorlesque, just, you know.
Oh, gorlesque, I've never heard that.
Gorlesque is, you know, anything that's involved, that's going to involve a lot of fake blood or viscera or, you know, all the things that you might see in a stage production of Titus Andronicus, but with boobs and bums and other bits out on display.
Yeah.
So that very dark, you know, horror-ish kinds of burlesque, you could do a name that fits that if that's what you want to do. I will say, if there's anybody listening who's thinking about getting into burlesque and who's thinking about a name, do your due diligence, because it's really, really important to make sure that nobody else is using the name that you want to use. It may seem like, oh, well, you know, we're a small country, we're hours away from anywhere else, but our performers do travel. And it, you know, it does come up. So it's,
well, I suppose
just,
it's like any kind of naming, isn't it? Because it's like when people open a company, when people open
confusion.
A business or something like that, and then you find out there's already a business with that name, and you're kind of like, well,
it's annoying. Yeah, but you need to come up with something else.
Yes,
and it's,
definitely. So, tell us a little bit more about the co-papa of Cabaret Coven.
So, as I said, we'd had the conversation about there not really being many stage opportunities for people like us. So we often say we're about making space for the weirdos. But it's really important to us, just like you were saying at the opening of the show, that Kick Arts is about making people visible. And that's what we're about too. It's, we want our audiences to be able to see themselves represented on stage. So all genders, all ages, all sizes. I'm really excited that next Saturday we've got, I think at my count, at least three performers who are over 50. And they're all incredible. I mean, the thing is that with the older performers, you've got people who have been honing that, those skills and those crafts and those different art forms for literally years and years, and it really shows in the elegance and the polish. But you've also got people who are coming and embracing burlesque as an art form or drag as an art form later in life and just throwing themselves into it and giving it their all, and that's just incredible to see. But for us, the only barrier as far as we're concerned is, do you have the courage to get up on stage and, you know, come up with an idea, put an act together, get up on stage and do it?
But it's not like open mic where you're doing it kind of cold. Like, you've got...
No, absolutely not. You've got to
apply,
to prepare,
they've got to rehearse, they've got to be approved, I'm assuming, by your committee.
So our process is that we'll put out, you know, this is the next show that's coming up, this is the theme, this is the kinds of, you know, this is a bit... We'll give people a bit more information about what's behind the theme and the sorts of things that that could involve. Mm. And then people apply. We've had the hard but good problem the last year or so of having more performers apply than we have space for, which is always, you know, it's always hard having to turn people down, but it's a good problem to have because it shows that the
there's a want and a need.
There's the themes that we're coming up with are resonating with performers, and they've got ideas, which is always really exciting. But yeah, so they'll apply, we'll go through and try and... We always try and create a balanced show. Like, for a show like this one, sadly, we had, say, multiple applicants with similar ideas, mainly around the Muppets or, you know, the big, you know, the big childhood media names, and you can't take them all because then it starts to be a different theme entirely.
Yes.
But we'll create a kind of balanced roster out of that, and then they have time to rehearse, time to prepare, and, you know, let us know what they're planning in a bit more detail, mainly in terms of what are we going to need to pick up when you finish your act, or what do we need to set up at the start, that sort of thing. And then they're away. And we always, you know, we would try to pay the industry standard for that kind of performance. That's really important to us, to sort of treat people as professionally as possible and make it as professional and caring a show as we can. But the other important thing for us is a mix of newer performers, more experienced performers, because we've always found that there's a huge benefit to just spending time backstage with other people, getting into those conversations, or being able to go up to a more experienced performer and say, hey, I know that, you know, we're not on in the same half. Would you mind watching my act and giving me some feedback? Or I've been wondering about getting into shows in your city. Can you tell me anybody that I could get in touch with? Or, and those kind of connections that are just so valuable. But if you... When I started out performing as Fanny McBangers, I remember being told, look, if you really want to make a go of this, you're going to need to travel. And that's great if you have the means.
Mm.
But if you don't, it's a lot harder to get established and start getting producers in other places to book you to make sure that you can cover your travel costs for a start.
Yeah.
So getting those opportunities in the city where you live is, you know, it's taking a barrier away from actually becoming better known and becoming more successful as a performer, because yes, there's an element of hustle, but there's also, as I say, that element of needing the means to actually push yourself. And if you're already spending your money on your costume and your rehearsal time and all of those things, then it can be harder to travel soon enough to be making an impact. So for us, creating that space is a way of getting more of the amazing Auckland performer community out there and visible.
Very cool. So, two things to finish with. Mm. One is, how can people find out more about Cabaret Coven, and if they wanted to get involved?
So, if you want to get involved, give us a follow on Facebook. It's the Cabaret Coven. On Instagram, we're at Cabaret Coven NZ. You can I would recommend seeing, you know, there's burlesque and cabaret artist groups on Facebook. There's the Aotearoa New Zealand Burlesque and Cabaret Artists group is a great one.
Great.
We'll always promote our calls for acts.
Yep.
There, or they can just email us at cabaretcovernz@gmail.com and say, hey, I'm interested in maybe performing. Can you let me know when your next show
is? And then, of course, another big thing they could do is they could support you.
Yes.
And come and see Ouch, Right in the Childhood, which is happening this coming Saturday at the Factory.
Yep.
At 8 p.m.
Yes.
See, I did my homework.
Yep. Doors at 7:30. But if you buy your VIP ticket, you can come early and meet and greet with our army of Kens. And who hasn't wanted to get a photo surrounded by, you know, life-size Ken dolls? So it's the bucket list item you never knew you needed.
And, of course, if you come that little bit earlier too, the bar's open.
Yeah.
You can buy your little nibbles.
You can get a platter. It's a whole night out.
Mm.
And then you get to see some amazing, wonderful cabaret.
And you can get your tickets through iticket.co.nz.
Yep.
And you can find that information out as well on our events page on Kick Arts.
We appreciate you.
No worries. So we wish you all the best for this
weekend.
We love to hear what you're doing. So make sure you do let us know once you've decided what's happening next year.
Still in the discussion process about what themes and how many shows and all of that. But
well, let us know when you put your shout out, because we could put that up on our What's On Events page too.
We will definitely
let us know. Now, our dear friend who's not here tonight and hasn't been for a while, Stephen, he's down packing in for Jersey Boys. You've heard me say every week that he's down rehearsing in Tauranga. Well, we've got a quick interview with him, so let's hear all about what's happening down at Jersey Boys.
Well, thanks, Emma. It's fantastic to have a chance to speak again. It's been a few weeks since you and I have caught up after nearly 5 years of doing the show together, leaving you for so long. But a big thank you to Adam for stepping in as well. As you know, I've been down in Tauranga and enjoying the sunny Bay of Plenty every Sunday rehearsing Jersey Boys, which is about to open. And I'm joined now by the assistant director, Daryl, and three fabulous cast members to chat about Jersey Boys. Daryl, how's it all going? We've packed into the theatre this weekend. Is it feeling real?
It's feeling very real. It's very exciting. Everyone is raring to go to get on that stage to light it up and just make some magic.
Amazing. So if our listeners don't know what Jersey Boys is all about, tell us the story in a nutshell.
My goodness. Well, firstly, we managed to pack 5 decades into the story, so there's a lot that we cover in 2.5 hours. We start in the 1950s, where we meet, I would say, 2 core members of what we know to be the Four Seasons, and then we follow their story, how they evolve, how they come to meet the other important members of their band, how they develop their sound and become the sensation that they are today.
Brilliant. Now, no pressure, because I'm standing beside you, so it's a little bit awkward interview, but how have you found the experience of being assistant director on something like Jersey Boys?
It's been a dream. I mean, and again, not because you're standing beside me, but I adore Stephen. He's been a wonderful mentor. We have a lot of fun while doing the hard work and addressing the things that we need to address. It's just been a really meaningful process from start to finish.
What's been the biggest challenge, do you think?
Oh, biggest challenge. I think always looking to refine effective communication and how you're making sure that happens, not only as a directing team, but across all channels of production.
Brilliant answer. I thought you were going to say the biggest challenge is going home with one of the cast members, because your husband plays Bob
in the show.
We'll segue to you, Keegan. A really pivotal role, Bob, in the story of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. What's it like taking it on?
It's a massive role, so prior to 2025, I hadn't been on stage in about 10 years. I made a decision that I better get back into practice, and so I was in the prom in town earlier this year and then auditioned for Jersey Boys and was quite surprised when I got the call to do Bob Gaudio.
How would you describe the character of Bob? Because he's a little different to the other Jersey Boys, isn't he?
He is. Quite like me, I think, in a way. I think it can be... he's probably, this isn't going to sound like me at all, but he is quite serious compared to some of the other ones. He's kind of there as a career, I guess. The music is a career, and so he comes in and it becomes, I guess, a bit less goofy once Bob arrives on the scene. So But one of the good things is he takes 35 minutes to appear. And so I've got a bit of time at the start of the show just to
warm yourself into it.
Warm up, yeah.
Because Bob's the famous songwriter, isn't he? He wrote some of the most famous Juicy Boy songs.
Totally, yeah, yeah. So, and it's kind of, he was in the band for a few years before they came up with Sherry, but after Sherry it was hit after hit after hit, and he wrote all of those. So,
personal favourite in the show?
Oh, What a Night.
Oh, yeah.
It is a solo.
Okay.
It is my solo, but but it is, I love the song. I've always loved that song.
Yeah, and let's face it, Bob has some fun in that song.
Does, absolutely. It's, and Lindsay, our choreographer, explained this probably best. It's the most musical theatre that the show gets.
Yeah.
So I do quite enjoy that we go a little bit musical theatre with it.
Brilliant. Now, Ethan, you play the very famous role of Frankie Valli. What's it like being the guy stepping into his shoes, knowing he is still alive today and still singing in America?
I don't know if I'd quite call it singing. What is that? Nah, bless. He's it's a great challenge. I remember prior to auditions, when I first found out that the show was coming to Tauranga, I was crapping myself. I was like, oh, Lord. Because I watched the show at the Civic a few years ago and I fell in love with the music. I knew a few of the songs already, but I didn't realise how the story came together and how much of a challenge they all went through. So when I auditioned, I put a lot of time into it, especially getting that falsetto right. That took a lot of work, but I got it there. And then audition came through, got the role, and then met the beautiful cast that we work with today, and it's a great cast, super fun, I'm ready to get it on stage.
So you mentioned the famous falsetto, and you're working with the fabulous Matt Bodman, our musical director. Mm. What are you doing to look after your voice now as you go into the season? Because, you know, we've had the luxury of speaking during the rehearsal period to different people who have played Frankie around the world, and all of them have commented on the taxing toll on your voice. And, of course, in professional theatre, they can take the day off, relax all day, but you've still got to go to uni and do a job. How do you look after yourself?
I don't talk when I don't need to talk, which is hard because I'm a big talker.
You heard that first here. Let's monitor that.
Yeah. I try not to talk when I don't need to. I drink a lot of water. I'm doing like 3 litres a day at the moment. It's paying a lot, which isn't great, but you get used to it.
But it's the key to the show, isn't it? Like everyone's coming, no pressure to hear that voice. That's that moment where an audience goes, ah, they've got it.
Absolutely. Just lots of water. Don't talk when I need to. Warming down is just as important as warming up, which I found out through one of the videos that we got from one of the Frankies, which was a great piece of advice.
Mm. Brilliant. Now, Alana, you play Frankie's wife, Mary, and during the rehearsal period we did speak to people who had met many of Frankie's wives and kind of talked about the dark side of the story that perhaps isn't over-portrayed in a two-hour musical. Mm. What's it like taking on such a serious role?
I love it. I really love it. Mary, well, she's such a tough woman, right? She's just so strong. She is probably the serious side, well, one of the serious sides of Frankie's story, at least that we see on stage. He has other challenges that he faces, but she's pretty full on.
What are you looking forward to most when it hits an audience?
Well, if it didn't move them, I'd be pretty disappointed, right?
Yeah. This is a laugh and crying type of show.
It is. Yeah. And there definitely are moments where you just feel for Frankie. Even though he's a bit of a ratbag.
Brilliant. Now, Daryl, there's some intimacy moments in the show, and this is your area of expertise.
Yes.
Tell us how you've brokered that on stage.
Well, it starts with having a director who's very accepting and encouraging of the work that you do. So by stepping in that role, I am able to just facilitate the scene and the actors involved, make sure that they feel not only comfortable with what they're performing intimately, but empowered and can really lean into the beautiful storytelling of it and actually make the intimacy the very last thing that they are thinking about when they go to perform that scene. If we do our job right, everything is grounded in character and purpose, and it becomes like choreography that's easy to repeat.
And you guys felt that worked for you?
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Love it. Keegan, the Kick Arts hidden microphone gets hidden out in the foyer on opening night. What are you hoping the audience say as they walk out the door?
Oh, well, Bob Gaudio was good. That'd be ideal. I really want them to understand that the storyline is real. I think one thing that sets Jersey Boys apart from other jukebox musicals, because it is a jukebox musical, is that the storyline is real, which means that it flows. You know, there might be some embellishments in the story, but ideally we want the audience to find out some history while enjoying what we're performing. So that'd be what I hope they run away with.
Beautifully said. And Daryl, it's at the Bay Court Theatre, which is sort of the capital arts scene here in Tauranga.
It absolutely is.
And what dates is it running?
From the 11th to the 27th of September, and you can get your tickets on Eventfinder.
Brilliant. Well, Emma, that's us. I've missed you heaps. I will look forward to being back in the studio in October, although I'm wondering if I'm going to have to kick you out of my seat, because I suspect now you're enjoying the controls and hopefully haven't hit delete on this record. Massive thanks to you and Adam for keeping things going. If you are in Tauranga, Hamilton, Rotorua, take the drive, even come down from Auckland and see the Barfoot and Thompson season of Jersey Boys. Take care, guys.
Stephen, you are so rude, as if I would have deleted anything. I'm doing a fantastic job, and yes, we can have Turnabout sitting in the hot seat. Now, while you were all listening to Stephen down in Tauranga, Fanny McBangers has gone home for the night to try and find some warmer weather, and coming in from the cold, straight from her final or first tech rehearsal, I suppose it is, we've got Chai Ling, who is busy with Let It Die, sounds a bit ominous, at the basement. Kia ora.
Kia ora. How are you?
Good, good. So tell us, there's puppets in this.
Yes.
There's other mixed media.
Yep. Some techno music, some surreal vibes.
Wow. And so tell us a little bit, what is Let It Die all about?
Let It Die is born from an urgency to capture this kind of dark, muddy, awful feeling that we're all kind of feeling compressing on our souls at the moment. Well, at least me anyway. And putting that into theatre that can make the audience feel seen in that feeling, but also bring a little bit of hope to the situation.
Wow. So this is a piece that you've written?
Yes.
And is it just you on stage, or have you got other actors?
So I wrote most of the script, and then my actors helped me devise pretty much the rest of it. Because this was such a fast turnaround moment that we kind of all just kind of reached a breaking point, I guess, and the funding landscape being so difficult, the recession. I haven't made an independent theatre show in a really long time because of a certain standard that my company, Proudly Asian Theatre, has for our works. And it's just been harder and harder to find funding, you know, the current state of everything and the government not exactly enhancing artists' experience right now. Yes, it's myself and three other female actors who are very experienced, and we made it really quickly. So we've only had 3.5 weeks of rehearsal.
Wow.
I kind of had the outline of the script when I came into the process and then was writing as I went. So the script was probably only locked about 2 weeks in, and now it's the whole thing.
Wow. And are the puppets characters in themselves, like, are they, if you've only got four actors, are the puppets helping you have more than four characters, or what's happening there?
I did think about that. There's almost a kind of everything everywhere all at once thread to the show, so there are multiple characters, but there are only three puppets in the show who are also playing other characters,
right?
If that makes sense.
Yeah,
so there's four of us, three puppets, and then a bunch of weird stuff happens. And you'll see them kind of over and over again in different roles.
Is this the first show that you've incorporated puppets into, that you have done?
No. So I was really inspired by the works of Ben Anderson, who was an Auckland-based puppeteer who has now moved to Melbourne. A few years ago, he kind of had this big blitz. He would do almost a show every year. So I probably was in about three of his five or six shows that he did that had puppetry as the base of the theatrical device. Mm-hmm. So these shows are not for children. For example, one of his shows that did really well was a show called The Suicidal Aeroplane.
Oh, I know that play.
Yes.
We did it, a little bit of it, when I was used to be a teacher at St. Kent's. Year 13's read it, yeah.
Yeah, so as you know, it's kind of bittersweet, dealing with really dark topics, but using puppetry in a way that's really inventive and interesting to kind of bring these things to life without becoming too didactic, and having a little bit of a interesting, abstract, surreal kind of twist to it. So, yeah, my shows have incorporated puppetry a little bit across the years as well. I did a show in 2018 called Orientation. It's sort of a twisted kind of pseudo mind game with this biracial woman who's trying to figure out, can you root your way back to your roots? So she's on this kind of sexploration, sleeping with a bunch of Asian men, being extremely problematic. And her parents are portrayed by a piece of white bread and a Chinese dragon. And so those two characters are puppets. And then the rest of it's real humans.
Wow. Yeah. So you write, you direct, and you act. Have you got a preference, or you just love doing all of it, or are you leaning a specific way these days?
I think definitely writing and directing is much more appealing to me these days, because there's something that's really fulfilling and interesting about getting inside the world and creating the world of your story. And I think as an actor, you can bring so much to it, but I think I do better on the outside, and I don't think I'm the best actor in the world. I think there are so many better actors than me, but I think my ideas are a bit more unique potentially than my acting style or my acting prowess. So I'm definitely leaning towards directing and writing, yeah.
And where do you find your inspiration from? Like this one, you're saying that it came out of a feeling or a thing that's happening at the moment. Is that kind of the norm, or is there other inspirations?
Yeah, definitely. I think everything that I make comes from either a question that I can't quite answer, or sort of an itchy feeling that I have where I'm like, why do I think this way? There's always a question at the heart of it, because I think if you know something really well and you kind of know where you sit with it, you know why you think that way, and there's no kind of internal conflict, it doesn't really occupy much space in your mind, if you know what I mean. But I think for me, what's interesting to explore through an artistic medium is those kind of grey area questions, or the things that you think that you know you shouldn't think, or you feel bad for feeling that way, or you don't know why you react in this certain way. I feel like those are things that all humans are really interested in, is kind of exploring why and how we operate in certain ways. So there's always a question, I think, and that can vary a lot. With this show, I think with a lot of theatre, because you spend so long pitching, writing, getting your ideas solid, getting funders on board, getting your crew on board, getting this or that approved, finding venue, etc. There's a whole lot behind the scenes. The ideas can tend to get stale if you don't manage to grab that funding, or if you don't manage to find those investors. So I think with this show, it's really unique for me because it was such a tight time frame to make it. I kind of wanted it to be like that, so that this feeling I'm still sitting in can be communicated now whilst I'm still processing it.
Yeah.
So it's a really unique piece in that way for me, because my other shows have taken, you know, several years to get off the ground, for example. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned before about your theatre company. So tell us a little bit about Proudly Asian.
Yeah, so Proudly Asian Theatre was formed in 2013 by myself and James Roque. We graduated from Unitech. We were one of a handful of Asian students across the whole school. We were always getting cast together, and we kind of both realized at the same time that it might be quite hard for us to find work. I'm biracial Chinese Pākehā, and James is Filipino Kiwi. And we decided to just start producing our own plays and putting ourselves in them, because at the time, we were consuming a lot of theatre by major theatre companies that didn't have a single Asian person in the cast. And across those 3 years we were training, we were kind of like, damn, we gonna die out here. So we started producing shows by Asian American playwrights and Singaporean playwrights. And then all these other Asian creators started crawling out of the woodworks and going, how can I join? How can I be on the stage too? This is something that we haven't seen before. So it kind of snowballed from there. 10 years on, we produce works, we foster writers, we have development initiatives, we have producer training. We do a lot of things, and we operate a playwriting series across Otutahi and Pōneke as well. We've actually got a call out for the Otutahi contingent, where if you are an emerging Asian writer, you can apply for a program that will help you deliver your first play. So that's online on our socials if you want to go have a look at that, if you're based in Christchurch.
That's so cool.
But yeah, that's what we do.
So are you part of that mentoring yourself? Like, do you mentor upcoming writers and new people?
We partner with people on the ground. So we're based in Tāmaki. So the people running the company now, myself and Marianne Infante, who you might know from Shortland Street and her other amazing acting work. She's been with Pat and running Pat with me for the last 5 years, I think.
She used to be a host on Kick-Arts.
Amazing.
Before we took over, when she was working with Richard and he worked at Yukanoa.
Yes, yeah. So you know her very well, I'm guessing. But yes, so she and I work with other people on the ground in the different centres to find local writers who can mentor our local writers, our emerging people, which I think is such a good model, just to have some face-to-face time to kind of get the community connected with each other. So, yeah.
But that's so cool, and it's interesting because, like, I was talking with Fanny just before about the fact that, like, Cabaret Coven is all about making burlesque people visible. Mm. You know, our kaupapa here at Kick Arts is about making the arts visible. Mm. So it's a bit of a theme tonight, you know, because Proudly Asian, of course, was about increasing that visibility and providing platforms for what was essentially a gap.
I mean, 100%, and it was pretty outrageous at the time, now that I think about it, because over a quarter of Auckland's population identify as Asian. Mm. And if you walk down Queen Street, you're like, well, you know, this is just the reality of who's in our country and who's been in our country for, you know, centuries. Well, not centuries, but, you know, we've got a deep, deep history that, you know, is rarely told or accepted. And I think we just really want to reflect the people that live in Aotearoa.
Do you think that means that prior to the visibility and the platforms that you're creating, that Asian actors and performers were just acting other ethnicities?
Yes and no. There was sort of colourblind casting that was happening. There's some Komatua Asian practitioners who were working before us in the next generation, like Renee Liang and Linda Chiang Mai Earl, and all those amazing people like Gary Young. But I think it was new that there was kind of a collective or a company that people were kind of could come to as sort of a base. But yeah, I think there definitely were roles for actors that were written, but they were mostly written by Pākehā playwrights or other playwrights who, it could sometimes be misrepresentations, kind of racist stereotypes. I mean, I played some pretty dicey Asian stereotypes in my time, just trying to get work, aside from Linda's work and Renee's work, of course, which was really groundbreaking and really inspired myself and James to do what we do. But yeah, it was pretty slim pickings back in the day.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. So you've been, let's jump back to talking about Let It Die. You've been packing in today and teching?
Yes, today was our packing day. It was a really good day. I'm feeling really energised about it.
So are you in the main theatre space at the basement?
No, we're in the studio. So
that's the
that's upstairs.
Upstairs, yep.
Yeah, and I think the vibe there was, it's a pretty renegade, you know, quick make show. But at the same time, that venue works really well because it kind of gives you a bit of a black hole feeling. It's quite intimate. It's going to be very dark. So it's nice to kind of have everything condensed into that space. What do you think's been the, apart from the only having 3.5 weeks of rehearsing, has there been any other big challenges?
I think the challenge across the entire art sector is money. And I would be remiss to say that it hasn't been difficult. But I think everyone kind of knew that that was happening going into it. We sort of accepted. Everyone on the team has chosen to do a theatre show rather than not do one. So be broke and make theatre, or, you know, be broke and be sad, I guess.
I suppose that's the decision you've got to make, isn't it? Because if you're not going to, I mean, nobody wants to do a show and know that they're not going to be able to pay their own mortgage, you know. So no theatre company wants to take a huge hit. But then what is the option to not pay people, or to go down the profit share model knowing that you might get $5 or just not do it?
Yeah, and I think for me, I have been working towards, in my career, having, you know, giving more space to say no to things if I'm not getting paid, and waiting for those opportunities, rather working in, you know, arts administration vibe to secure funding, working on my business model, etc., which has been going really well for Proudly Asian Theatre because we took a business hiatus, which has allowed us time to kind of reshape those things and hopefully rely on government funding less. But on a personal level, I think running parallel to that was the fact that I need to keep making art to be a good arts practitioner, to be a good leader, and to keep running my company, to you know, hopefully inspire other people and be, you know, the best that I can be artistically, not just administratively, which I think I was falling down that hole. So for me, the sacrifice of having to do this with no money and no funding is really hard, but at the same time, the payoff for me is just so great, to kick myself back into that artistic practice, to take some really big artistic risks. And I think that also, you know, process makes product. The rehearsal period was so short, and we've kind of just decided to do it so quickly because we can't really take much more people's time in making this. I think that's a massive consideration for us. It's not something that I take lightly. And so that's why this show is also being produced under my company, Rather Die Productions, with support from Proudly Asian Theatre, because with Proudly Asian Theatre, we would much prefer and have mandates around financial support as well.
Yeah. Crazy. All right, let's take a quick music break. So this is the latest track from Brother Sister, and it's called Oasis.
Always see.
And that was Brother Sister, another one that I found off. You guys are going to be sick of hearing me talk about new hatchlings, but it's a really good Spotify playlist of all new New Zealand work. So, coming back to Let It Die, sounds so... Is it the feeling that you want to let die?
I guess you'll have to find out. No, I hate when people say that. I think it came from this vibe of it's a sort of double-sided coin. So I guess having the kind of weight of the world on your shoulders and wanting to just give up and kind of just like roll into a ball, pull the covers over and just give up on everything, you know, screw the funding round, screw the projects, like screw my deadlines and just, you know, there's nothing I can do to make the world a better place. This is an awful situation that's happening. Genocide, right-wing stuff, anti-Māori sentiment on the rise within our government. And, you know, it just all seems like it's, you know, we're not making a dent to try and stop it.
It does kind of make you sometimes think too, because as a independent arts practitioner, you know, I had someone say to me the other day, had I ever considered in the 8 years that I've had Stage Antics and Kick Arts, etc., had I considered going back to being a full-time teacher, where at least I know that I'm going to get a fortnightly pay and this is how much it's going to be. But having said that now, given what the government's doing with education at the moment, hell no would be my answer.
Yeah.
And the Creative Cup. You know, it's really exciting being an independent practitioner, but I don't know whether people actually realise how much work it takes to put on a show. It's all the background stuff as well. Like you said, it's that admin stuff, writing the grant applications, constantly posting. And I think the thing I found the hardest was learning how do you stop being a tall, you know, the whole tall poppy thing. How do you actually put your hand up and go, I'm here, I can do that without seeming pushy?
Yeah, I think that's a tough one because I think it sort of reminds me of COVID era where people were really struggling, life was really awful, things were really horrible, and people are just watching so many movies, TV shows, listening to music. That's all we had was the arts to keep us alive. That feeling has kind of felt very relevant to me now within the kind of storm that's happening. And it's not just me. It's not just me as an arts practitioner. My friends who aren't in the arts are all feeling really bogged down by it all, the recession, everything. Everyone's struggling really hard.
Imagine if we were making bread now, like we were in COVID, paying the price we do for butter.
Yeah. Somewhat worse in that regard. Yeah. I've just given up dairy now. I'm just like, I can't, I'm a vegan not out of choice. But yeah, so I think that feeling, the let it die, kind of front footing that, but almost in a very like blatant, ironic kind of way, like, ugh, you know, let's just all roll over and cark it. But at the same time, I think, Let It Die refers to more of a Buddhist sentiment of, you know, ego death and kind of this perception of self and perception of expectations of things. And I guess the expectation or the feeling that life should make sense, the play is slightly absurdist in that way where absurdism comes, brings into the theatre space this idea that
life is chaotic. It makes no sense. There are no patterns, no rules, and we're just kind of dust motes floating around in it, and there's no point to anything. For me, my play is slightly more hopeful than that. I think my but, you know, of the whole situation is human connection, because I think regardless of if we're dust motes floating around with no control and no plan and you know, we can't control anything in this life, we still have other dust motes floating around in the same position. And that, for me, is quite hopeful. So, yeah, Let It Die refers to both of those things, that feeling, that horrible give-up feeling, but also, you know, how do we start from a place of, okay, let's approach each other as the solution, and human connection as the solution. If we can let down our expectations and egos and ideas of self.
Very true. So where did the arts all start for you? Like, if we go back before Proud Asian, back before Unitech, when did you start, or when did you know that this was your thing?
I would say I was really into arts and crafts since I was a small child. We didn't really grow up with a lot of technology, so I've never really touched a Game Boy or a PlayStation or anything like that. We had one computer, and so we had a massive backyard, lots of clay and sticks and toys, and so I think that kind of forces you to be a bit creative when you don't really have much technology, you know, to play with like the other kids. So yeah, I think really early on, all through high school, I did drama and arts, fine arts. I was maybe going to be a painter, and then I decided that it was so painful being super shy. I used to be a very, very shy and awkward child, and I kind of made the decision to force myself into drama because I wanted to become better at living in the world and just be braver with life, because it was very painful to be that shy. And that kind of just kept going. And I realized if I chose a career in fine arts, I would probably regress and go back into a hermit mode.
Mm.
And so I kind of chose to pursue the opposite thing. And here we are.
Who did you have, like, a strong influence as a teenager coming through drama? Like, who was it that pushed you into Unitech, for example? Was there a drama teacher or...?
Yeah. I'm still friends with my old drama teacher from high school. His name's Paul Willis.
Oh, we love Paul.
He's great. He's done Pop-Up Globe. He does kids entertaining. He's writing a book. He's amazing. But, yes, he's a very... interesting American
clown.
He's just a clown of a guy, and he and I had a very kind of what do you call it when you kind of like rib people all the time? We had a very like antagonistic relationship through high school, but he very much supported me to do whatever it is I wanted to do. And you know, even in our first production, we rehearsed at Birkenhead College because Paul was supporting us in that way. So he's been like a friend for life for me. We're still pals to this day, but he was just like, yeah, do it.
That's fantastic. And were your parents supportive in you going down an arts journey?
Yeah, and I think this really bucks the trend of, I guess, like, you know, Asian parents not being happy with their kids in the arts. My dad's a very progressive Chinese Malaysian man, and surprisingly, he was extremely supportive of what I wanted to do. And I think that secretly he would have done something artistic with his life had he had that same support. So I think he's kind of gone a 180 on how he was raised, which was very, very traditional, quite strict and, you know, focused on doing the right thing and joining a business and making a lot of money. And he kind of flipped the tables on that and was just like, do what makes you happy. And now he has to buy tickets to my shows and support me. So, but he loves it, yeah.
So what would you say, one of our good old Kick-Arts questions, and I'm not going to make it, we normally ask what you'd say to your 16-year-old self, but given that what you've just said about being quite shy and that, what would you say to someone that maybe was coming to the end of their secondary education and was contemplating going down the arts way?
Yeah, I mean, I would recommend it. It's really tough. There's no money yet. But I would say that it will challenge you to become a person that you might not otherwise. Mm. I think being a part of the arts is like living multiple lives in one, exploring different topics, finding out what really is important to you. It forces you to have good communication and connections with others. There are a lot of different art forms that are folded into one, especially if you do something like theatre. You've got, you know, the sound element, the design element, the spatial design, you know, the tactile props, the costumes, the human emotions and the story. So something like art, theatre or film can really bring you a lot of enrichment in so many ways that I think will allow you to live in the human experience more fully. That's my point of view anyway.
Yeah, no, I think that's fantastic. And when you look at like Toi Fakahde's training in like production management and stage management and all those kind of things, like there is a lot of work out there in our industry for non-actors. Like it's not just all about being in the front performing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you don't really realize that until you're in the industry. I think if I had known that there was a role called art department, I probably would have been like, hell yeah, straight out of high school, I'd probably be doing that now. But because I only knew that there was acting and nothing else, I went to Unitech. Now I'm a writer, director, and more theatre maker because I love all of the aspects. But I think, I don't know, there's just nothing to lose when you're that age. And I think if you're in a position where you can financially make it work, you can work side jobs, you can try your hand at different things, if you're in a position to be able to do that, I would say that it's going to enrich your life more than you could imagine.
When you were at Unitech, did they do the I was going to say internship, but that, I don't know if that's the right word, where they send you out to work with a company? Yes, and you have to do like a time with them.
It's a convent.
That's it.
Yes, I went to Singapore and I interned with a puppetry company called The Finger Players.
So cool.
Yeah,
it was so great. You knew at Unitech that puppeting was something that you wanted to be a part of?
Yeah, it was really interesting to me, and that was a really life-changing experience because I think puppeteering was used by The Finger Players as the basis for all of their shows. So they have like visual theatre and puppetry at the core of everything they do. And a lot of the time their work is not for children. It can be horror-based or have cultural mythologies or be about really problematic human psychologies, political stuff. And they use puppetry to kind of elevate those things in a way that breaks you out of, you know, your regular thought patterns, because you're just seeing things that humans physically can't achieve.
Yeah.
So that was really inspiring to me because I'm not super into kids' theatre. So Let It Die is actually not for children. I probably would not take a child to see my show. Not that it's R-rated, but it's just got dark themes and it's delivered in a kind of strange and adult way. So that's been a constant source of inspiration, The Finger Players and that internship. Yeah,
and it is quite cool. I mean, I was trying to, just while you were saying that, I was trying to think of, I saw a show years ago at Basement. It might have been at Angels in America. It was one similar to that where the guy, the main lead, actually died because of AIDS, but they swapped him out while he was dying for a puppet, and it was the puppet, and it was kind of like the big, what are the puppets called where they use multiple people, that Asian style? I'm just trying to remember.
Like a Bunraku style.
Yeah, that puppet, kind of style. And when it took its last couple of breaths and things like that, it was incredible to watch. And what was cool about it too was they had the actor kind of was having an out-of-body experience watching himself die. But it was so incredible. And I kind of thought about it afterwards. And it wouldn't have worked had the actor pretended to die. It just didn't have that emotional moment.
Yeah.
So, puppets are great. And I think they're very underused.
Yes, because I think there is that perception that it's either Muppet style, Sesame Street, I don't know, like sock puppet or marionette. And honestly, I don't really love many of those forms I just mentioned. And most of my work doesn't really have those types of puppets in them. They're usually invented specifically for the show, and they're created to bring about some kind of sense of, I don't know, surrealism, I guess. And they're not childlike in many ways. These puppets that I am using for Let It Die were created for a series of workshops that I did for Asian puppetry. So this was to demonstrate Bunraku style three-person puppets.
Right.
So I created them with Paul Lewis for those workshops. And then the idea of the show kind of sparked from them. So there is an innocence and a tactile kind of organic nature that comes from those puppets that I've subverted by putting them in this really dark, intense, weird, nonsensical world. So I hope that it creates some interesting contrasts and moments for the audience.
So if we were to put a microphone in the bar at the basement, what kind of things would you hope people are saying when they leave Let It Die?
Yeah, I think I hope they fall in love with the puppets, and I think they will. And I hope that it changes their perception of maybe what puppetry can do as an art form. I hope that artists who see it can see puppetry as something that might elevate their own practice in unusual ways, or make their storytelling easier to achieve, or fulfill something that they thought was impossible. And I hope the audience will be talking about the relatability of the feeling across the play, and can have a little quiet moment to sort of feel seen on their drive home and feel like, okay, let's, you know, things aren't so, we feel terrible, but we don't feel so alone.
So what's in the future for you or Proudly Asian?
Yeah, so like I mentioned, we have our fresh off the page Ōtotahi call out for writers happening right now. So if you're an emerging Asian writer who is based in Ōtotahi, Christchurch, please go on our social media and find the form to fill in. It's a very short form. Then you can find a bit more about the program and how we might support you to write your first play. The other thing we have at the moment is a call out for actors. We have four roles for a new show that we're launching in December. It's by Woo Young Choi, and it's called Genuine and Stable, and it's going to be on at the Herald Theatre in Tāmaki Makaurau, Auckland. So if you're Auckland-based or have connections there that you can stay over the rehearsal period, jump on our socials again and check out the casting brief, because this will be our first show that we have produced since our hiatus. So we're very excited to launch that.
Very cool. And what are you doing yourself going forward?
Sweating about my life. Such a confronting question. I'm actually doing two things. So I'm production designing for Alyssa Madell's upcoming show. She's writing and directing a beautiful two-hander about two Filipino cousins. It's based in Davao. It's a little ghost story. It's going to be on in October, and it's called Ilang Ilang. So I will be set designing.
How exciting.
I'm so excited.
Yeah.
I set designed for Let It Die, and I kind of fell in love with it. It was amazing. So that's coming up soon. And then I'm going to do the Robert Lord Cottage residency in Dunedin at the end of this month. So that'll be cool. I'm writing a kind of speculative fiction, political story about the Antarctic Treaty and how that's coming up for renegotiation in 2048, I believe. And that's with my friend who's a scientist, who's very interested in climate and geology, Jeff Bonning, who's coming over from Australia. So a big
awesome. Well, we appreciate you coming out on Sunday night, given that you open on Tuesday and tomorrow is your kind of last rehearsal day. So thank you so much when you could be at home doing those last minute things that you probably need to do.
No, it was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And we wish you all the best for your season, and look forward to hearing about anything in the future. Make sure you stay in touch with us. We're coming to the end of our show, guys, and it's been a pretty full on weekend, and apart from this, actually, I was earlier today watching a group of kids do High School Musical at the Dewdrop Centre with National Youth Theatre. It was a great show, so well done to you guys. And busy week ahead. I feel like I've got lots of things coming up. Friday night, I'm going to ABC's of Musicals. Saturday night, I'm going to Buckland's Got Talent. So lots and lots coming up. So remember to tell us, though, what are you doing? Let us know. info@kickarts.nz. No, kickarts.org.nz. See, it's Sunday night. My brain's going fuzzy and it wants me to drive home before it gets too much wetter. So we're ending tonight's show with the latest track from Mikey Videotape, Needle in a Haystack. So have a great week. Make sure you kick some arts.
Searching for your light, forgotten, precious opportunity you've stolen. Prove yourself to yourself, words can change the landscape. You're praying on the generous, you're stealing on the kindness. Oh, my open book, hear my vulnerability, things that you can never take away, campaigning against me, falling for a whisper of learning tinker, every transparent step I we'll be right back.
Your Language on Planet